Hi, and welcome back to another episode of Sea Control, a podcast series brought to you by the Centre of International Maritime Security. I'm Natalie Sambi, I'm your host, and today we'll be talking about Australia and amphibious capability with the Australian National University's Dr. Peter Dean. But before we get into that, we'll be back after this short break.
SIMSEC brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. And, like the United States, SIMSEC is, and always will be, free. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership, which gets you daily emails of our articles and a WordPress account that sends your own writings directly to our editorial staff. However, admin, special projects, software, events, and prizes do cost money. There's a new option to make a voluntary monthly donation at the bottom of every SIMSEC article. No matter how you choose to support us, those who volunteer for leadership, our amazing content producers, our readers, our listeners, our conference planners and attendees, and our financial benefactors, we are incredibly grateful. Remember, Sea Control is more than just a podcast, and SIMSEC is more than just a website. We are a vibrant community built on a passion for discovery and discussion. Sign up, write, donate, comment, or even leave 5 stars on our iTunes page. Join us today.
Hi, and welcome back. Today we'll be talking about Australia and amphibious capability. Today joining me is Peter Dean. He's a senior fellow at the Australian National University's Strategic and Defence Studies Centre, and he's also busy as Associate Dean of Education at the Coral Bell School of Asia Pacific Affairs. Thank you very much for joining me.
Good to be here.
Peter, you've recently had a co-authored report with Lieutenant Colonel Ken Glyman, who was over at ASPE with us for a little bit from PACOM. Your report's entitled Beyond 2017, the Australian Defence Force and Amphibious Warfare. Today I was hoping to delve a little bit deeper into some of the reasons why we're looking at developing amphibious capability and what some of the challenges are and what that might mean with partnering with allies in future. So, just broadly speaking, why is it that we are looking at developing amphibious capability? Like, do we have one? What does it comprise so far?
So the Australian Defence Force at the moment has got what we would call an emerging amphibious capability. Certainly there was a legacy amphibious capability. So the old LPA, Manura and Kanimba class ships that we had that had been redesigned, refitted out after being coming across from the Newport class ships from the US Navy. And that in a small Tobruk LSH, landing ship heavy, and a few other smaller craft. It's a very niche, very small level, low level of capability. And now what we're moving to with the two very large 7,000 ton LHTs is a quantum leaping capability. And with that quantum leaping capability, or platforms at least, we have to have a capability to come along with that platform. So the ADF is being required to do things basically in terms of amphibious warfare that really hasn't had the capability to do since the end of the Second World War. So it's a long gap between now and then. And so the ADF is having to learn new things, things that are new to many members of the ADF that may be common to other Marine forces and other navies around the world, but not so much to Australia.
Sure. I mean, you talk about the long gap since the end of the Second World War to today. Has there been a time in between, perhaps, when we've identified when we've needed an amphibious capability? I'm thinking here things like Interfet.
Yeah, well, certainly Interfet in East Timor was a turning point for Australia in amphibious warfare. So we already identified after some incidents in the South Pacific early in the 80s, so Operation Morris Dance with the coup in Fiji back in 1986, and that we really didn't have any force projection capabilities in our region. So the defence of Australia was largely a sea denial operation and was built around sea denial capabilities, but we realised we actually had to operate into the region. So that really kicked off the drive and development to the two LPAs that we acquired, the old Newport class from the US Navy. But they weren't yet in service when East Timor happened in 1999. And what became glaringly apparent was the lack of an amphibious capability for us to operate in the region, particularly when we were supported over the horizon by a US Navy MEU and the ability to have large heavy lift helicopters to be operated off that platform to support Australia was a very big noticeable gap in our capability. So very much the current LHDs we're getting emerged out of the InterFed experience and emerged out of the white paper that followed that and the assessments that followed the East Timor operation in 1999. And of course, we went back to East Timor in 2006 when we did have Manura and Canimbla, and we were required to put an infantry battle group across the shore, across the beach. So that's been really those touchstone points for us in developing that capability.
It's been a little bit of time since 1999 as well. I mean, we're talking 2015 here to develop that amphibious capability. I mean, East Timor is more of a peacekeeping and stabilisation operation type contingency. Has our ADF identified, or our white papers identified, exactly the kinds of contingencies, the kinds of operations we're looking to use this amphibious capability for?
Not really, and I think that's one of the problems that we've had
that's
at the moment.
That's very interesting.
So there was, emerging through the 2009 white paper was a very clear indication the ADF had to be able to operate in joint and combined warfare in our primary operating environment, which is particularly focused around Southeast Asia and the South Pacific, but also out into the Indian Ocean as well. This was very much followed on in 2013. In the 2013 white paper, now there were 40-odd mentions of amphibious operations, amphibious training, amphibious capability there, but they were still not very clear and coherent in exactly what we needed this capability to do. So there's been sort of two thresholds that have been set. Certainly a threshold around HADR operations and sort of baby-stepping through into this with that level, but you don't buy two 27,000-ton amphibious assault ships to do HADR and regional engagement. So there is clearly a warfighting concept or an idea sitting behind this, but that's not really been clearly articulated. Hopefully the next forthcoming white paper in Australia will do that, in hopefully the next month or so when it comes out. But certainly even if that provides some clearer guidance, the concept of operations document inside the ADF needs to be developed more, and there needs to be much more clear thinking about the strategic role and purpose of these platforms and this capability.
I mean, you and Ken talk about that developing those concepts a little bit further. You know, could you expand a little bit about what you think, how you think that should be carried out?
Well, I think this capability has lots of different effects. First of all, the ADF's got around to adopting a maritime strategy, and a maritime strategy is not a naval strategy.
Yep.
It is a joint warfighting strategy, and amphibious operations for an island continent like Australia, living in a littoral and archipelagic region like it does, it's absolutely critical if you're looking at operating in the South Pacific or Southeast Asia, either on our own or in partnership with allies and other partners in the region, to be able to have some force projection capabilities and able to operate and manoeuvre around the region. That is everything from our HADR stuff to our potential warfighting capabilities. And of course, this platform, I think, will have a very big role to play in enforcing the peace, in diplomacy, in building partner capacity, and in doing regional engagement activities. And it really takes regional engagement to a whole nother level, which is something the ADF has also been talking about as a centrepiece of what they want to do. Sending one ship, one frigate, one Anzac frigate up somewhere to visit, there's only so much you can do with an Anzac frigate. You send an LHD with, you know, anywhere up to 1,000 troops on board with helicopters, you can do a range of activities with local partners and regional partners with that type of capability. And you can have as little as that as you want, or as much as that as you want, because of the flexibility of these ships.
Sure. And just for our listeners' sake, we're looking in our regional partners, we're looking at countries in Southeast Asia, we're looking at countries in the South Pacific and New Zealand and so forth.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the big thing is, of course, our alliance with the United States and operating more with the United States, which both the US and Australia have been talking about for a long time and building the alliance out. But also working with New Zealand in the South Pacific, working with our other partners in the South Pacific as well. But I think the area that the ADF should be focusing this on a lot is on Southeast Asia, on getting involved in multilateral HADR operations, getting involved in multilateral confidence-building exercises into the region, and also as well as working bilaterally with countries such as Singapore, with Indonesia, with Malaysia, and with Vietnam and others. And I think these platforms provide a huge leap in the capability to do that type of engagement that the ADF hasn't really been able to do in such a flexible way before.
Just to return a second to this concept of maritime strategy, I mean, Australia, you mentioned earlier, is an island continent. You know, being surrounded by water, I'd like to sort of just dig a bit deeper. Why have we not, up till now, in your opinion, developed a maritime strategy?
Well, Australia's broader strategic picture has and circumstances has really been wrapped up in our alliance relationships. You know, early on in Australian history, we were part of the British Empire. We had the protection of the Royal Navy, which ruled the waves and had maritime supremacy in our region. After the period of the end of the Second World War, our alliance with the United States has filled that very similar vacuum, and a much more stable Asia-Pacific region backed around US hegemonic power and basically maritime supremacy has really allowed Australia to spend particularly time in the 80s and 90s and more recently fighting in the Middle East, because, for want of a better phrase, the backyard's been relatively quiet and hasn't presented as many challenges. And so therefore, we've had a more posture built around what single service force elements we can drop into coalitions with our partners and send to places as far away as the Middle East. Australia's strategic circumstances, like that of the whole Asia-Pacific region, are changing. Australia's been more actively engaged in recent years in the region, particularly from the time of Intifet and East Timor in 1999, and that's not going to go away. Australia's second only to the defence of Australia in our defence policy for a long time has been engagement and operations in the South Pacific. And certainly our alliance partner in the United States sees that as our primary area of responsibility, so we need to be able to conduct operations there. But as we expand more, particularly in maritime security operations, and also more with our partners in the region, that Southeast Asia is becoming more and more important to us, as well as other parts of the region as well. So I think this is about the strategic centre of gravity moving to the Asia-Pacific, an Australian recognition of this, and a recognition that our relationships with countries like Indonesia and Southeast Asia and other countries are changing, and that we need to pay probably a more forward-leaning, more interactive stance with military diplomacy and military engagement into the region, rather than protecting ourselves from the region.
Sure. Just in terms of operationalising this, so now we've got this thing called Plan Bathsheba. For the benefit of our listeners, can you just give us a quick overview of what Plan Bathsheba does, because that's the sort of the departure point for developing this amphibious capability?
From Army's point of view, very much so. So Army, in its identifying some lessons from constantly being on operations in the Middle East for a very long period of time, realised that having three regular army brigades that were organised completely differently with completely different structures, one motorised, one light infantry and one armoured or mechanised brigade, was not really conducive to constantly rotating forces out on operations and developing planning cycles and training cycles. So the army's moved to a three brigade light brigade structure, so they're all medium weight brigades, they're on a readying and reset phase. And so that structure has been integral to how Army has organised itself, and that's what Plan Bathsheba is really all about, is that three-like brigade structure. Now, the big question is how do you integrate the amphibious capability into this rotating system? So what they've done in the interim is one of the brigades, three brigade, has had an extra infantry battalion in, some extra resources allocated to it, to do some pilot and testing and evolution work from Army side on amphibious warfare. This is really only sustainable out to the 2017 mark, they said, when they'll test the proof of concept of an amphibious-ready group, which were basically putting all of the 2nd Battalion Royal Australian Regiment on both the LHDs, all of the enablers and the helicopters and everything, to see if it works, to prove that it works. But at the moment, the ADF doesn't have a plan after that. And this is why the report talks about beyond 2017. Beyond that proof of concept, what will the ADF do? How will Army will account for doing this? And how will Navy organise themselves, and how will the joint capability development piece of this be done? And this is what our report's fundamentally about. The big emphasis in here, the biggest challenge is for Army. Navy's come up with a very intricate but well thought through plan on how to operate the ships. The key question is, how do you turn a Navy capability into a joint capability when you start adding the Army platforms, the helicopters, the logistics and the combat troops? Mm-hmm. And the engineers and all the other support elements onto those ships as well. So it's the big challenge, and what we identified in the report, that some of the biggest, probably the biggest challenges are in Army, the Australian Army.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, I mean, for our listeners, we're talking about maritime capability and amphibious, we're talking only about Army, and you're saying some of the challenges are lying in that joint space there. I mean, would one of the solutions be just to raise the Marine Corps?
Well, that would be a very big cultural change for Australia, and also, really, the size of the Australian Defence Force, I just don't think could sustain that. Of course, there has been the proposal put forward by many that you just take one of these brigades and turn it into a Marine brigade. And certainly many of the ex-Royal Marine and Royal Navy officers that have been imported into the ADF to help support this capability have very much pushed this idea. The question then is, what happens to the other two brigades? Do they become very hollow? And again, we fall back to the non-light brigade structure. And if you actually have to deploy these troops on operations, how do you have a system in place to cycle brigades, combat units around in a like-for-like process and manner? Of course, for amphibious operations, that's about getting to the fight. It's about getting ashore. But once you're ashore, and if you're there for a while, how do you sustain that presence over a long period of time? If you invest in just one brigade, you really risk hollowing out the rest of the force.
Sure. So you talked just now about Navy managing the ships and this being sort of a major question for Army. But getting back to the joint issue, what are the challenges in that space and what do you think the ADF can do to meet some of those challenges?
I think the real big challenge is that amphibious warfare is a joint domain. So systems often operate in the system we have here, with a single service being very dominant. That if a service owns a particular capability and is heavily invested in it, then it gets a lot of attention, it gets a lot of resources. But when you start moving into a joint space where it's quite unknown who owns what and what priorities is for the different services, it makes it very difficult. So we looked at quite a bit in the report about how you manage that joint capability space. The Australian Concept of Operations for Amphibious Warfare identified 19 capability shortfalls. And for many of those 19 capability shortfalls, it's not sure whose responsibility is, whether it's Army or Navy's responsibility to fill that shortfall. Certainly there's big questions around who's going to pay for it and where that money's going to come from. So I think the first principles review that happened earlier this year, which proposed some big changes in defence around capability management and development, I think will help that greatly. But we've really pushed, they need to identify and empower a joint capability manager, someone that has similar powers and responsibilities to single service capability managers, and with a clear line and budget out of the Australian Defence Force to fund that. And really, only by doing that will they really be able to come up with a sustainable system to identify and fill these shortfalls and these gaps in the capability area.
So moving from the practicalities of developing this amphibious culture, I want to touch a little bit more on the more abstract elements that go into this. You alluded earlier to there being perhaps cultural shifts to developing a Marine Corps. Perhaps if we're not going that far, if we're only developing amphibious capability, what does an amphibious culture look like? You identify that in the paper. What does that look like and how are we going to get there? And why is it important?
So Australia is in an island state with a continental mindset and mentality. The often spoken about thing, particularly by the Royal Australian Navy, is our national anthem talks about being girt by sea, but many people say it's really girt by beach, because as far as Bondi Beach is as far as we get. When we look beyond the surf break, Australians don't have a lot of interest in that broader maritime space, that broader island and archipelagic space.
So it's about maritime awareness as well.
It's about maritime awareness, very much so. So our army's been largely a continental land army that's plugged in. You know, the First and Second World War, we sent a significant number of troops overseas to serve in a British army. Then in the Pacific in the Second World War, embedded as part of a combined force with the United States fighting in the islands to our north. And we developed an amphibious culture then because we were required to do so. And then we went back to that similar alliance relationship where our army went off and fought counterinsurgencies and conventional operations in Korea, in Vietnam, in other places embedded into broader coalitions. So we've never really in the last few decades had to focus on this. So there's a lack of sort of understanding, a lack of acceptance and knowledge around, and amphibious operations are very complex. So building an understanding, a complex knowledge about what it means to be maritime and what it means to operate in an amphibious environment is something that we really don't have. And this has been demonstrated by the fact we've had to import expertise into Australia. So ex-Royal Navy and Royal Marine Corps people. The current Colonel Amphibious at our Joint Deployable Force Headquarters is a US Marine Corps Colonel and has been for the last couple of postings. And of course, we've been exporting Australian officers to the United States to get trained by the Marines over there to come back and have some knowledge. What we really need to do is start developing training systems inside Australia to develop that knowledge ourselves. So we have to come up, and what we proposed in the report here is an amphibious centre of excellence, a way to embed that knowledge, that culture, that learning, and be able to train the force properly with Australian concepts and Australian ideas, because we won't have a Marine Corps. We will do things a little bit differently, and that's all right, because this is a unique Australian strategic problem and it needs a bit of a unique Australian strategic solution. But it also needs to be a solution that maps in with our allies and partners. But we can't import complete US Marine Corps ideas. The US Marine Corps is four times the size of the Australian Defence Force, and the Royal Marines operate with a different sort of force level and strategic concept and operating concepts as well. So we need to embed a culture. we need to develop our own expertise, and we think the best way of going to do that is to develop this amphibious centre of excellence to capture the training requirements, to capture the education requirements, and to help spread the knowledge and do the conceptual development as well.
So for the second last question I've got for today, I mean, we talked a little bit about, you know, we're not going to be a Marine Corps, but it occurs to me that the Marine Corps has additional assets that our 2nd Australian Battalion, Royal Australian Army Battalion may not have.
Yes.
Aircraft, for instance, and things like that. I know on the blog there's been a little bit of discussion about the use of LHDs as mini aircraft carriers.
Yes.
If we're going down this road, what do you think about that? To what extent is that an option?
I'm not a fan of V-style aircraft on these capabilities. I mean, these are fundamentally purchases as amphibious ships with rotary ring assets on board. They weren't designed. Certainly the one Carlos class in Spain have used Harriers off them as well. But the more Harriers you put them on them, the more infrastructure you need to support them, the less of a landing force you're going to have on board. I mean, the weapon system of an amphibious force is the ground combat force that you're going to put ashore. The mobility that it has, the strategic surprise it can use, all those wonderful assets. If you start putting the V-style aircraft on them, you start removing that particular part of the capability away. We only have two. If you really want to do that, what you do is buy a more purpose design ship with that particular approach in mind. And really, for what purpose? I think that's the big question not too many people have asked, and certainly not answered here. Why would we need an LHD with, say, 6 F-35 V-style aircraft on them, you know, when you'd have to have a couple in maintenance, a couple flying? You're probably going to get 2 aircraft at best at a time, and you're going to suck up a lot of money, a lot of cost. To what effect? Certainly it's massive overmatch in the South Pacific, and it's massive pretty much undermatch anywhere else. And of course, if we're going to go into the high-intensity, high-end warfighting, there's not too many situations I can find that where we would do that without the support of land-based air power, with tanker support, which increases the range for that, or conversely, without the support of our major ally partner, the United States, who operates very many large nuclear carrier groups that no one else in the world can match. So I think there's a lot of problems from everywhere, from cost to the actual purpose of this. So I'm certainly not a fan. They were brought with a specific purpose in mind, and we need to focus on getting that right first, then maybe have a look at some of those questions later on. But I'm still not convinced when we look at them that there will be a real strategic rationale behind doing that.
Seems like it gets back to that issue again of a lacking maritime strategy and a maritime awareness. So just to recap, you know, we've got a couple of challenges there. We've got the maritime strategy, we've got the joint concepts, developing amphibious culture, and then obviously then developing our own centres of excellence to be able to capture that education and, you know, help that infuse throughout our military. Last question for today. What do you think the biggest challenge that is at the moment facing the Australian Defence Force when it comes to this issue of developing amphibious capability?
I think capability development management and money. So we've, you know, part of the white paper, we're going through a force structure review. To do this properly, it's going to take an investment of quite a lot of money. The ADF has and the Australian government and the Australian people have invested a lot. These ships are not inexpensive assets. If we really want to get the most out of them, though, you know, a capability is not just a platform. It's everything that comes with the fundamental inputs to capability. It's going to take some significant investment. We've seen some very positive signs from the former and current Chief of Army and certainly the former and current Chief of Navy around this. When the rubber hits the road, how much money is there going to be able to do this? To be able to meet the single service requirements that those services need to fulfil, as well as this joint requirement as well. And if it's not funded properly, if we don't set up the proper training and education systems and we don't have the proper concepts around it, then it could atrophy, or basically they could be very expensive platforms that are very underutilised. So I'm really hoping that the force structure review embedded into the forthcoming Defence White Paper provides a lot more clarity around the role and purpose of these vessels and this capability, and of course the funding and support mechanisms in place and the personnel to be able to do this properly.
Sounds good. Sounds like there's a lot for us to think about how we're going to use these platforms in the future.
Absolutely.
Great. All right, Pete, thank you very much for that.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
And to our listeners, if you'd like to read more about amphibious capability in Australia, don't forget to check out Pete and Ken's report BN 2017. I'll provide a link for that. You can follow the rest of our podcasts at simsec.org as well. Don't forget to leave us a 5-star rating and join us again next time. Thanks very much.